what's up with you?
Well, I'm not on fire, for starters.
You have to rub it in.
I know, it's a real low bar here in 2020. Not on fire, nobody has COVID. I guess we're doing fine.
So I have these daily stand-ups now, right? And the team that I'm working with is on the East Coast, and the last couple of days it's been orange, and they can kind of see the window in the corner. When on the stream, the webcam is clipped, but they can see like the widescreen, and it just has looked dark every day now. And so they keep asking me like, why is it dark there? Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I've been looking at the satellite imagery, and obviously the pictures, the real kind of apocalyptic Blade Runner 2049 pictures. It's just out of control, man. It's just wild.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I'm fortunate to not have to work outside or be walking around in it, but I have friends that do have to walk around in it, and hopefully they can stay healthy. And
at least we're all wearing masks already, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I screwed up and I walked Watson around yesterday without wearing a mask, just around the park and stuff like that. And when I got back, I felt actually kind of weird. I felt not great. And it dawned on me, I was like, oh yeah, air quality's not good. Cause I'm just not used to that, having to worry about it.
Yeah. Wow.
But, I mean, all in all, like, we're doing okay here. There's a lot of smoke and stuff, and we went out and got an air purifier, so that also helps too. But thankfully, we don't have to actually worry about being evacuated or having to deal with that stuff.
I saw some links flying around our Discord. I'll put some in the show notes of homemade, like, box fan air purifiers you can make yourself. Just get some kind of filter material and strap it to a box fan with a bungee, and that thing will move a ton of air.
I think I saw something about that on Twitter. Sure, I saw something about that on Twitter. Yeah, I should probably look into that. We have one now that works in the office in the bedroom. So I guess if I'm in the office, I'm working or playing games. And usually the only time I'm in the kitchen or living room is if I'm cooking. So I don't have to worry about that quite yet. But I should probably look into it. Yeah, it is what it is, I guess. I don't know what else I can say about it, really.
Yep. Well, I'm glad you guys are doing safe and being okay up there. Yeah, but things have been going good over here. I've been jumping around to a lot of different things, not really working on the web side of things very much at all recently, actually, aside from just the regular little bug fixes and stuff here and there. We've been pushing forward on our hardware migration, you know, replacing all these radios, and that's just, you know, just an ongoing project. We're very, very close. Like, there's only two or three left that are on the chopping block, so that's good. So once that transition is complete, then I can really start focusing on making that experience really good, because it is still kind of buggy and not great. You know, we're with these new radios, they have what's called, we call it a pan adapter, which is a waterfall and a pan adapter. I don't know how to describe it.
Pan adapter.
Yeah. So what it does is it's a graph. It shows you sort of a visual representation of the radio frequencies, right? So on the left side is, it's like an equalizer, right? You know, an equalizer, low frequencies on the left, high frequencies on the right. It's like that, except it's for RF. So we can show you like a whole chunk of the spectrum, and you can kind of visualize where all the different signals are. And that's great. And it looks really cool. And it's nice because it's visual. You can instantly see all the activity. You can click around, and you know exactly what's going on. But it's a lot of bandwidth. You know, we're streaming those at like 20, 30 frames a second, and it's like they're about 1,000 pixels wide, like per line as the thing scrolls past. Mm-hmm. It's like this waterfall view, so it's kind of like a rolling, you know, kind of keeps rolling down. So yeah, we've been having issues with just, I don't know, WebSockets, man. Like sometimes it's CPU issues where people's CPUs just can't handle painting the thing. Sometimes it's network issues where it's just the latency is really bad, or we're getting drop packets, and I don't really know. It's a really uphill battle because I can't recreate it. And so now I'm at the point where, okay, I have to manually get in touch with people, schedule like appointments, so I can remote into their computer and see what the heck is going on, because without that information, like, I can't even, what can I even do? I can't, it's not actionable, but it's a real problem, you know? And that's the worst, the worst kind of problem.
Yeah, that doesn't sound great.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about, like, okay, can I paint things in the screen more effectively? Like, I'm using Canvas API right now, which is, you know, just 2D drawing stuff. Could I use like WebGL or something like that? That might be using GPU acceleration. That might be more efficient. Could I try compressing the data to reduce bandwidth, you know, using some kind of thing? Could I just reduce the resolution of the data, reduce the frames per second? Like all kinds of little games you can play, just kind of shave off that performance, you know, headroom, give you some more headroom. So I just don't know what the silver bullet is right now, but I'm just kind of stuck in that loop right now.
Yeah, that's never fun, especially if you're having to work through performance issues or trying to work through performance issues and you don't know what the biggest win is for the least amount of work, right? Because that's what we're always told, right? Is look for the least amount of work for the biggest gain. That's where you start. And it's like, okay, well, what do you do once you get past that? Then it's just sort of, you know, spinning the wheel forever until you've, you know.
You get it. You got to get it good enough. And right now it's not good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, then it's just like there's lots of, to set up that pipeline of the data, there's lots of pieces involved with, you know, Electron, WebRTC, data channels, that kind of stuff. So it's like there's a lot of pieces that all need to be set up and torn down. And if any one of those things goes wrong or starts to become a bottleneck, you know, then it, that's where the problem's going to be. You know, we're using on the server end, we've got these little Raspberry Pis. When you're connected, they have four cores, and Electrons, they're using about 80% CPU spread evenly across those four cores. So each core is about like 20 to 25%. So like, I feel good about that. The fact that it's, you know, not pegging one core, and the fact that it's, you know, yeah, it seems pretty high, but it's also doing a lot, and it's also JavaScript. So it's like, it's not very efficient at all, you know?
Yeah.
I could be doing this in Rust with like straight up UDP packets, and, you know, it would use a fraction of that, but that's just way less maintainable, and you still have to do WebRTC stuff, and there's all these other reasons why it's just not worth going down that road yet. But
that would be adding another pretty large layer to the cake that you've already got going on with Ruby, Elixir, JavaScript.
Yeah, there's already so much tech in the stack, and having some form of Chrome, you know, basically on either end of the WebRTC connection, to me has been like, it felt like a hack at first, you know, before I was doing Electron, I was literally running like Chrome with some like feature flag set and running it in, you know, virtual Windows on like a headless Raspberry Pi. It's a mess, but it does work. But, and I went away from that, but then Chrome API started getting newer than like the WebRTC, the native APIs, and things just started, I don't know. It's hard to say. Like the best implementation of WebRTC is what's in a browser, and so it just makes sense to run a browser on both ends, because
Right. Otherwise
you're just chasing a rabbit the whole time.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're not really, you know, you're not. What's the saying? Like, you always want to be as close as you can to the production.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Yep.
Yeah. As cool as Rust does sound and seem, I agree with you.
I'm going to come back to a little bit, because there's another issue I've been having that Rust might be one of the answers. So the other thing I've been working on for RHR has been this new hardware device. I think I mentioned on here before. I picked up recently because, again, it's really, really important to get right for this new radio architecture. What this thing is, we're calling it the KeyMate. I don't know if that's what we'll actually call it, but that's what the name is in development.
KeyMate.
And what it is a box that will let you, in theory, send perfect Morse code over the internet, which is not as easy of a problem to solve as you would think.
What do you mean by perfect Morse code?
Right. So Morse code is, you know, just dots and dashes, right? And there's lots of ways to sort of generate Morse code in a modern way, right? You can, the, you know, old school way is just with a straight key, you know, just a little, you like, think of the guy, a Morse code operator on the Titanic, right? He's got a little key and it's going up and down and he's sending individual, you know, symbols.
Mm-hmm.
That's called straight key. There's a mode you can use called where you have paddles. So you actually have two keys side by side. They're sort of next to each other. And you push one and it generates dots, and you push the other one and it generates dashes. And so by alternating, you can control, you know, you can basically generate the same symbols, but you know, in a, at a constant speed, basically, without having to send each thing up and down individually. It just kind of generates them as you, as you're holding down the paddles.
Okay.
And then there's mechanical variations on that. There's one called a, like a bug, I think, or a, like a Vibroplex is the brand name, where like it uses this weird mechanical damper. So that way when you kind of flick it with your thumb, it sends dots, but only because it has like a series of springs to make it like swing back and forth like a pendulum.
Like a doorstop?
Yeah, exactly. You flick it and it goes beep, 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 because it's flinging back and forth. But then it also has this cool damper. So when you go to send a dash, it just completely damps it and then stops the vibration. So you can send the dashes or the dots real quickly, but then you hold down the dash and it stops the vibration. It's wild.
That seems like it'd be tough to get used to.
It is. It is. It's definitely an old school way of doing it. And that's, you know, some of the OMs, the old men do that, like that style. I don't know. It was before they, you know, it's a mechanical keyer.
Well, at that point, it's almost like playing an instrument, right?
Yeah, really it is, because you have to get the timing down right. You have to adjust the position of the weight to, you know, control how fast it is. And then the dashes, you have to, like, you're controlling the length of the dashes, right? The dots are an even spacing, but you have to control the dash by yourself. So, yeah, I've never done it. It seems crazy.
That seems pretty cool. I didn't know that that last thing existed.
Yeah, it's called a semi-automatic mechanical bug. I don't know why it's called a bug. They also have electronic bugs, which simulate that. It's kind of what the paddle is. It's kind of like an electronic bug. And the last way to send Morse code is obviously just with a keyboard. Like you type the letter A and it'll send da-da, right? Like it'll, you can type a keyboard and it'll generate the Morse code for you in various number of ways. You understand that, I think.
Here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
So you get a Raspberry Pi with the light sensor, and then you allow them to send Morse code via a flashlight. Just like the ships used to do.
Yeah.
I got another idea. I'm full of ideas here. So you get a smoke detector and you wire it up to Raspberry Pi and you can send Morse code via smoke signals.
Oh yeah, they have those kind of visibility sensors, right? Where it's like infrared and it detects like the particles, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You could do smoke signals. That'd be cool. Very, very low bandwidth though. Like, what is it, like 0.3 baud?
That's the point. The message has really got to carry weight, you know?
Well, it's funny because I did consider one option for this was like, okay, we have WebRTC, right? WebRTC, we know, does very reliable audio. And they basically, you know, they handle the stuff with buffering and timing and stuff so that when you, what I say comes out reasonably well on the other end. So my thought was, if I could somehow take the Morse code, like the actual tone, and feed it into your computer via mouse or via sound card, and then send that audio just as a regular WebRTC audio stream to the remote computer, and then somehow interpret, like do DSP on that audio stream and convert that into like on off signals. Cause then you don't have to reinvent the wheel of buffering audio and doing all that stuff. You can do it at a really low data rate. Who cares? It doesn't have to be, you know, it could be 1 kilobit per second. It doesn't matter because the bandwidth is so small. It's one of the crazy options that I actually considered.
That's wild.
you could make a little circuit, takes the output of the sound card, and basically once it rises above like a certain volume, you just open and close, you know, the connection to the radio. It's possible. But I'm not doing any of those things. What I've got is this microcontroller on this little board that actually has a really good, you know, timer, could measure within like microsecond precision. So I basically just timestamp every time you key up or key down and send that across the wire. And then on the other end, there's the same piece of hardware that takes those timestamps in, buffers them by, you know, some amount, and then replays them, you know, on the same kind of time reference. So that's the idea in practice.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then also has a mode where you can just do ASCII. So like, anyway, it doesn't matter. But the problem is, and this has always been an issue. So, and again, this is kind of reinvent the wheel because this is just how streaming media works. But like you have some chunk of data, you need to get it across the internet in a reasonable amount of time. And then that needs to be played back to on the other end, right? And the internet, even on UDP, right, where you don't have you know, acknowledgement or packets or whatever. Packets could be lost. So that's one thing you have to think about. The other thing that could happen is two UDP packets might take two totally different routes through the internet, depending on, you know, how they're being routed at that particular time. And it could be consecutive, right? Depending on the load of the switches, depending on, you know, what's up, what's down. The latency between two individual packets could vary by quite a bit. And so you have a situation where maybe one packet comes before the other one, even though they occur, you know, in the opposite order. You have an issue where one comes so late that it's not even relevant anymore because, you know, you tried to buffer a certain amount to play back, but like maybe it's 100 milliseconds and then your packet comes 200 milliseconds late. Well, what can you do? You have to throw it out. Like, it's already irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been really fighting with basically that jitter, right? What's the variation in how long it takes the packet to get from X to Y? So like, you know, when you ping a site, right, you get a, you know, bunch of pings back. Maybe I'm pinging 40 milliseconds, 41 milliseconds, 39 milliseconds, whatever. It's all, you know, 40 plus or minus some milliseconds. So that's fine if that delay is constant, because on the other end, like, you don't care. It doesn't know about that delay. But if the delay is changing rapidly or a lot for any reason, whether it's the network or the CPU on either end, you know, getting bogged down, like, that's going to cause you problems. And so that's where I'm running into these major issues with this, getting this to work, is like, not so much the network issue, because I can't control that anyways, right? But dealing with how do I get a tiny, tiny piece of data from this board to a board across the country in a reasonable amount of time.
That sounds like a tedious problem to solve.
Yeah, and it's again, talking about unreliable things, it's just so dependent on the whole setup and the state of the internet at that any given moment that it's hard to, you know, reliably recreate. But like, again, in the back [S2] Right. [S1] Of my head, this is a solved problem. People do this all the time. We're doing live video and audio at way higher bandwidths than this stupid Morse code thing. And it works fine. So this is a solvable problem. I just am trying to distill it down into this really, really specific use case. Again, I was talking about latency with the data. Like, there's a lot of hops right now that this data has to go through. So this is a serial device, okay? So it shows up like a serial port, so you can just talk to it, you know, with a mm-hmm. with a terminal. So you plug this thing in and start sending serial data. Here's the path that it takes to get to the remote site right now. Serial data gets sucked up by a native application on macOS. It's a little Swift application. On Windows, it's a little C# application, just a little CLI. Sucks up that serial data, pipes it to standard out. Electron on the user's computer takes that in, sends it over a WebRTC unreliable data channel, which may or may not go over a proxy somewhere in the cloud because you have double NATing or whatever. Ends up on Electron running on a Raspberry Pi. Then it takes that data and sends it to the Ruby main server process via some form of inter-process communication, I forget. I think it's a Unix socket. Then Ruby takes that and sends it to the serial port on that computer. And then it finally goes to the microcontroller.
So it's a game of telephone, is what you're saying.
it's like a giant switchboard.
Right. And how that all sounds so, you know, as software developers, we think about testing and we think about isolating, you know, like mocking what you don't own and isolating your tests to make sure you're hitting your stuff, but not trying to test someone else's stuff. And then I start to think about microservices and how that sounds like a nightmare. But then I think about this too. It's sort of like the same thing. Like, how can it possibly be deterministic, right? At some point, like you said, if the wind blows a certain way and a cable rolls around once, it could change a value, right? It could introduce like a random that happens that throws everything off. And that sounds to me like I would throw my computer out the window.
Yeah. And so the game is trying to improve what you do have control over.
Sure.
Right. Everything outside of that little cloud on the block diagram. That's the internet. And that's where I think, honestly, you could see a lot of gain. describe this to you, there are a lot of steps. And if I'm being honest, the biggest, the most unreliable factor, the one that you really, really, really can't control for, is the friggin' user's computer. Huge, huge spectrum of OS's, capabilities, laptops, desktops, you know, Mac, Windows, overloaded by CPU, like, you know, running at the limit, fans screaming, like, who knows what the hell people are doing on their computers.
Like my computer right now.
Yeah, yeah. Your poor MacBook.
Well, it's only 170 right now, so we still got a ways to go.
Yeah. Fahrenheit or Celsius.
Fahrenheit, sorry.
And yeah, so I'm trying to figure out if it's worth it to go down the route of, like, at least bypassing the user's computer. So I guess my two big options now are, right now, option one, forget about Electron altogether on the user's computer and have some little native, probably Rust, thing that can talk to a serial port and just, like, send crap to UDP packets somewhere. And then we can figure out what to do with it. You know, anything to get out of the user's computer as quickly as possible, right?
Right.
Into the serial port, out through UDP, native compiled instruction set, done, right? Or you could go get even more extreme. These little microcontrollers, you can actually get versions of them that have Ethernet right on the board itself.
Okay.
And I've actually been playing around with this, and it works really, really well. Because it's a little, I mean, this, when I say microcontroller, this is a 600 megahertz ARM processor. Like, this is,
okay,
this is no slouch. And it's running on this thing that's, you know, a half stick of gum.
That's still so cool.
It's amazing, dude. It really is. This is the Teensy 4.0, by the way. I'm talking about Teensy and 4.0 and 4.1 are what I'm using for this. And it's just an awesome, awesome platform.
So now I'm thinking about, so like Thomas in the chat is talking about, you can run Rust and Electron with WASM. Let me tell you again, you can run Rust and Electron with WASM. Earlier we talked about, you know, not picking Rust because it's adding another layer to things. Like, it's another thing to know about, another thing to maintain. But what's the least evil here, right? Is it adding Rust so that way you can physically limit the amount of time that's spent in other people's machines, if that's one of the biggest factors of frustration at this point, right? So is it adding a new language, a new thing to have to know and maintain and keep up to date? Or is it having to work around, if you're leaving that the way it is, having to work around, find like other places to work around, right? What do you think is like the biggest evil to avoid there between the two?
I guess it just comes down to your priorities, right? Like, do you value, is it going to solve the issue for the users? And do you value that user experience above everything else? And if that's true, if both those things are yes, then you have to do it, right? There's no other option.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of have to, you know, we talked about last week about how making decisions in service of the customer, right? Like, you might not get to use the tool set you want to work with to, you know, just because you're opinionated about it doesn't mean that it's the right thing for the job.
Right.
Doesn't make me want to actually do it, you know, actually go down that road anymore, but
sure.
But also maybe it's not a big deal. I don't know. Like, it also might not even solve the issue. I might go down that road and like try it, and maybe it doesn't actually make a difference.
Right. Maybe the time spent there wasn't as big a deal as we thought it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I know that if I put a friggin' Ethernet port on this thing, then the number of variables is effectively zero.
Hmm.
Because you literally have control end to end at that point. You right. control the hardware. Okay, maybe you have to rely on the user's like router and internet connection. But again, for very small packets of data, it should be fine. You have to rely on the internet. You can't control that. And then the station end, you just have to make sure that your hardware is set up on that end to deal with it. So it's like, and you do have to figure out NATing and how to route the data and stuff, because then you're not even using WebRTC. Like, WebRTC is great because it lets you set up these arbitrary like data channels. You can just send binary data, whatever you want, back and forth, JSON or whatever you want. And it's great because it automatically bypasses firewalls for you. So like, it's a whole class of problems you don't even have to think about. Whereas if once you're down the like the network level, you have to start thinking about like hole punching and proxies and all these crazy techniques to get through firewalls so that this thing actually freaking works.
Sounds like a nightmare.
It is. That's why I have really, you know, hesitant about it. So, yeah, I know it's a lot. Maybe it's not that interesting, but it's just like, I don't know. It's just going to take time and just, you know, benchmarking the crap at everything. And maybe what we have now is good enough. I don't know. I don't think it is, though, because we've gone down this road before and hit some roadblocks. So I think we're going to have to go another level deeper and figure this out.
Must always go deeper.
Got to go deeper.
Always. Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear about because it's something so different from what I deal with on a day-to-day basis. I know almost never to think about that. In fact, like the project I'm working on now, it's a very controlled environment. It's not open to the general public. In fact, the number of people that are using it is going to be pretty small. It's more of like a sales tool for something. So thinking about all those performance things, like, yeah, we don't want it to be slow. We don't want it to be, you know, bloated, but it's not a thing we have to think about right now. We have to like think about the I guess speed is part of the experience, right? And all that stuff. But really it's more so thinking about, did we even make the right features that people care about? And I think once we get that question right, then it can go on to the, you know, yak shaving, I guess, to performance and stuff like that. But that's a whole thing, I guess. Like, so when you're talking about, like, you know, trying out the Rust thing, we don't even know if it's the right thing to do. We don't know if it'll work or solve our problem. One thing that's really interesting that I've seen here at my new job is that they have this whole research role, and that whole research role, like, they might come in for a whole project and it's just like user research. Are we building the right thing? Do we even have the right assumptions? And I've never worked with that department at all. So like, I was on this call with our clients and the researcher's coming in and she's like, okay, well, what are our assumptions here? What are you assuming about your customer with this thing? And so he goes through the list and then she starts to poke holes like, what about this? What about that? Are you sure that's the right assumption? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then we come out the other side with this big document and then she just goes off and tests it with their customers. So they just pass her people they want to test with. She goes through this whole thing and validates whatever assertions they're making. And she's either like, yes, you're right, or no, you're not right. We're not building the right thing. We need to change the roadmap. And I'm thinking to myself, like, this is awesome.
That's a really, really cool resource to have.
Yeah. I was about to say, like, sounds like you need a research department, Rockwell.
Yeah, I am the research department. You're looking right at it.
Yeah. That was one thing I didn't realize that I struggled with as much as I did with DK and Sidedoor, is just not having that.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many plates that you're spinning. You just get stuck. You can't think about anything else besides the work that's on your plate. You can't think about like approaching research in a different way. You can't think about anything besides, I have to get A, B, and C done, or this is broke or that's broke, or someone or someone's are demanding this feature, right? You just have so much less bandwidth.
Yeah.
Or it might be not less, but a limited amount. You have a finite amount, basically.
Well, we do have a podcast audience. And so if anyone has any ideas or experience with sort of anything related to real-time streaming protocols, streaming hardware, interfacing hardware with Ethernet, like doing all that kind of stuff, you know, any kind of IoT stuff where time is critical, I'd really appreciate some feedback. It's just if I'm going down the right road, or what people's experiences have been to you know, get this kind of solution figured out. Because, like I said, I don't know. I'm confident that I'll figure it out. Like, I know we can get it to work. I know one of these solutions will be good enough. I just don't know which one and how long it's going to take, you know, how much effort it's going to take to actually get there and how fragile it's going to be. So,
right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in the long run, if you don't have to go down the Rust path, what can you work on in the meantime that provides maybe more value to your customers, right? If that's the main goal at the end of the day, as opposed to spending time in research that may or may not ever see the light of day.
Mm-hmm. And I really don't want to make I would love to throw an Ethernet port on this. And it's really not that hard. It only increased the cost by about $3. So, like, totally worth it. But I'm kind of running out of room on this board with connectors. And also, it's just, there's a lot of complexity around, you know, setting that stuff up. Because the reason, again, I'm utilizing WebRTC data channels is, like, it's already set up. I'm already using it. I've already got this pipe of data from me to the other peer that I can utilize. And so that's, you know, my quickest way to get started. But if I throw an Ethernet port in this thing, then the user, I guess, has the option, right? If they've got an Ethernet port available to them, they can just plug in and get the best experience, right? If they want a slightly degraded experience, then they can still use a serial port, you know, as it works now. And then they could just, you know, then it's on you, right? You know, we gave you the option to make it the best thing possible. And, you know, if you fall back to a crappier experience, not my problem.
It's your fault for using IE6 in the first place, right?
Deep cut. Is that a deep cut now?
Yeah, maybe I should say it's your fault for using IE11 in the first place, huh?
So anyway, yeah, that's just what I've been spinning my wheels on. I've got 6 of them built right here that I'm going to send out to some people for testing. So that's going to be cool. See what we got. The other cool thing I've been doing is I get these great little aluminum enclosures from a company called Hammond, and they come with blank aluminum end plates. So what I've been doing is actually I measured the plates, and then I actually designed the end plates as circuit boards because I've already got a manufacturer that makes great boards. I can put whatever labels and holes and square cutouts I want on them. I can get them in like 5 different colors.
That's cool.
And they're little circuit boards that fit perfectly on the end of these enclosures. So instead of having like 3D print something or have something made up by a machine shop and, you know, bulk orders of like thousands, I can just order these like 5-10 at a time for next to nothing, and they look great. So that was a cool little hack I picked up going to one of my conventions. I saw someone built some hardware like that, and it just kind of blew my mind a little bit.
What you need is a blue color like these full drives. This was one of my favorite guitar pedals of all time. But the full drive 2 MOSFET pedal, it's one of my favorite pedals of all time, and it has like a sparkle powder, like a sparkle blue powder coat.
Ooh,
on it.
I like that. I like that.
Such a good pedal.
That's like those. It reminds me of like a one of those high end Chevy SS, like something like that.
Yeah. So I still have one of these in Santa Cruz somewhere. I have gear scattered across some different states I need to collect up on, but this pedal was one of my favorites. It just had a lot of character to it. You could flip it on overdrive, and then you could, you know, play really light and your amp would be clean. And then the harder you strum, the more it would break up, but you didn't have to rely just on the amp's gain. You can kind of get that feeling at whatever volume you're playing at. So it was a super versatile pedal, and then it has a boost on it, of course.
So it gives you like a dynamic range.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's actually one of the things. Talking about circuit design, like that was one of the first things I started doing when I got into like doing this stuff was actually guitar pedals, because they're just really simple circuits usually with basic components you can build yourself. And yeah,
it's been a long time since I kind of went down that rabbit hole, but I've spent countless, I don't even know how much money I've spent over the years on like building pedal boards and just chucking the whole thing and starting from scratch. And like, you know, I would at some point buy, they make a custom wiring kits. So you buy a wire kit and you can cut it to length. So that way you can get your patch cables perfect. You don't have extra.
Nice.
Yeah. So you can get your pedals exactly where you need them. And then they even ended up, I think this is kind of when I was getting out of music, but they started shipping these solderless built for these wires. So you snip it and then you screw the wire into the tip that plugs into the pedal, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't even have to solder anything. It would just sort of be like this quick thing that you could do.
Yeah, we've started using those. They make breakout cables for D-sub, you know, like serial connectors, DB9, DB15, DB25, right? Like, you know, those old school like printer ports and stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of our gear uses that, and like that's the only, they're just general purpose IO, but they just use that connector. And man, it's such a pain to try to make those things. We end up just buying those things that just have screw terminals on them. It just breaks them out until, you know, you just with little terminals and you just go to town and make whatever custom cable you need.
Yeah, I mean, I would be trying to make cables and just be burning myself. Like me and my friend Jonathan, we'd just be burning ourselves, like trying to fix our stuff. Or I remember I was in tour on Florida. Or I was on tour in Florida one time, and we're playing an outdoor show. So they had one of those kind of like, you know, those metal stages where the stage is like higher up and they have like the metal scaffolding mm-hmm. on each four corner and all that stuff. And they had the tent on top of it, and it started raining, and we had already loaded our stuff on the stage. So it was in order. So like when, what happens is when you load in, headliners, they load in their stuff first, and then the bands, according to their slot, they do their they load their stuff and do their sound check. So all of the band's gears were already up on stage, and it started raining, and the it wasn't a canvas tent that was wider than the stage. It was just like one of those blacktop stages. And so all of our stuff was getting wet. And I had a couple of my pedals get shorted out, or I think it was like a cable between them getting shorted out or something. Yeah. So I remember just like breaking my stuff, trying to fix it, and then just having to buy new stuff, which really sucked. But
that sucks.
I probably should have learned what I was doing at some point along the way, but I never really did.
The thing that always was weird about pedals is that they use 9 volts, but they use like inverted polarity for the connector. So the plus is on the ring and the minus is on the tip. And I know there's some reason for it, but I just always seem weird to me.
Yeah. So one thing that I did was, I'll post a link to this in the chat as well. Is I had one of these Voodoo Power Labs. I still have it, in fact. And each, so you have, say you have 10 guitar pedals on your board, you need to power all 10 of them individually because they all have their own power input. And you could get what's called a daisy chain. So you'd have one end that plugs into the wall or whatever, and then it's just like, it looks like a Christmas light string, right? And so each light would be a plug that you plug into a pedal. But what happens is, as the power goes through the pedals and out, it goes in one, out the other. If you have a pedal that's dirty or doesn't have the best wiring or circuitry, it'll color the sound going into your other pedals. So this Power Lab, what it does is it has... the one that I have has, I think, like 9 inputs or 9 power slots, and they're all on isolated circuits.
Yeah, that's cool. That's the way to go, man.
It has a fuse built into it, too, in case you're playing at a bar and you plug your stuff into the wall, you don't have to worry about blowing your pedals up, because I've seen it happen. It's a tragedy, tragedy. Anyway, that's like the extent of my knowledge, is just using this stuff.
No, I mean, you need a lot of... you know, basic electronics knowledge to deal with that stuff, like especially dealing with ground loops and stuff, right? Do you have to deal with that? Or you plug it in, you just get like a 60 hertz hum on just everything.
Yeah. So how I fixed that was I bought a Furman power conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
And I would plug the power conditioner into whatever I was getting my power from. And then my amp and my pedals would both plug into the power conditioner. So number one, the power conditioner would clean things up and sort of isolate me from whatever, you know, dirty power was coming in. But also it also had fuses in it. So if I'm, you know, plugging into a bad wall socket in a bar, it's not going to blow my amp and my pedals up. It's going to blow the fuses in the power conditioner. So
yeah, we had issues with, these new radios where I had to, it's a long story. There's fancy digital radios that get digital audio out, but for reasons, we have to actually take analog audio out of the back of these radios with just like basically a headphone jack, right? But we had this issue where when you would transmit, you would hear like a garbled version of your own voice on your receive audio. Right. So you're transmitting RF over the air, but you hear like that was getting into the receive audio somehow. And we had to add basically what a power conditioner does, like, you know, or a isolator. We had to add isolation transformers so that our USB sound card was electrically isolated from the radio, and that fixed it instantly. The way we figured that out was actually used a guitar pedal thing. We used we just experimented with it and then just copied the circuit for it and made our own version. I wish I could remember what it was called because you would probably know it. But anyway, yeah, just isolation transformers to, you know, keep those circuits separate.
See, back then, these were all of my tricks of the trade to get good tone. That's what I prided myself on was...
Why did you just use a main stage?
It was kind of a pain back then, to be honest. I tried it a little bit. The software just wasn't, it didn't have the dynamic range that I needed it to have. I think these days the software would be totally fine. Like I would probably not go the real tube amp route over software these days, because software is getting so good to the point where you can actually mimic, I think, dynamic. So if you've never been plugged in, like have a guitar plugged into an amp and it's sitting behind you and it's cranked up, you can turn around and point the guitar at the amp and you just start getting this natural feedback. So just by playing near an amp, like a loud amplifier, you start to get these like natural tones. It feels very different. And then when you plug into a solid state amp or something digital, it just didn't feel the same. It felt cold. It felt too cool, if that makes sense. Too sharp, maybe. And now these days, it's like I can't even really tell a difference anymore. That's how good the software is.
So you're not one of those purists. Like, you obviously you like the gear you have, but the technology is good enough now that you would be okay using that.
I think that if you're playing live shows, or even I guess making records, there's so much processing that gets put on stuff. So, well, I guess like if you're making records, there's so much processing that's already put on things that at the end of the day, you probably can't tell. You give a record to somebody and they probably cannot tell you whether it was digital or analog, or you probably can't just tell. Playing live also, there's, I don't know, just so much stuff happening, like people yelling, you know, like if you're in a bar, people are yelling and throwing stuff or whatever, making noise. The PA is loud, the drums are cranking, like you could also not really tell.
Most of the time you can barely even hear the vocals, so.
Right, all you hear is the cymbals, so.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think like the software these days is so good that I would probably spend money on software versus an analog amp these days.
Just way more convenient, right?
It's way more convenient and versatile, especially versatile. What's really interesting was that there's all these, like this new generation of these players coming out, like Pliny and Jacob Zytecki and another one, what's his name? David Maxim Micic. So if you haven't heard of any of them, check them out. They're like prog rock guitar players. But David Maxim Micic has a YouTube channel. I was watching one of his videos and he makes all his music at home and it's all digital bass. And so he was talking about this amp software that he bought. And it's just, I think it was the Pliny pack from, I'll put a link to the show notes. But anyway, he was talking about it like it was a real amp. He's like, with this amp setup, I really don't have to buy another amp again because it's so versatile. I can get any sound that I really need out of it. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, oh, wow, he's right about that. Like, I have everything that I need here, and I don't need to, because a lot of people might be like, well, I want this sound, so I need to buy that, or I want that sound, I need to buy this plugin or whatever. And at the end of the day, they all kind of end up sounding relatively the same, unless you're like high gain, low gain, whatever, blues amps or whatever. But he was like, this is like a real thing. And I never really thought about the digital stuff that way, in the sense of like using it like it is a real amp and trying to be as versatile like as I can be with one set of plugins or something.
Right. Because right, that's the thing. If you buy a piece of physical gear, yeah, you want to utilize it to, like, it's taking up space. It's a real thing. So you want to use it to its maximum potential. Whereas a plugin, it's just money, right? Like, you can buy 100 different plugins and try them all out and have choice paralysis. But if you just have one, and you know, really get to know it and learn it and own it, like, that's the same as owning that gear.
And in the same way that if you get to know this thing and you get really familiar with this thing, you can learn how you can push it in ways that maybe it wasn't meant to be pushed, or you can kind of coax sounds out of this thing that make it unique. Because if it's digital, you can always, if you're trying to go for a certain sound, you could always just buy that plugin to get that sound. But if you don't do that and you use something that you already have, you can try to, you know, morph what you have to that. And then at the end of the day, you'll probably end up getting something more unique, right? Something special. And I'd never approached digital stuff that way before. I was like, okay, I want a Marshall sound, let me buy a Marshall. I want, you know, a diesel sound, let me buy a diesel. But yeah, the way he like described it, it just kind of like changed my opened my mind, like how to think about it. So.
Well, wait a second. Isn't he also selling that plugin?
No, as his own? It wasn't his. No.
Oh, okay. I going to say that'd be convenient. So are you going to go up on stage with your new MacBook 13-inch or what?
No.
Why not?
It's Metalab's 13-inch MacBook Pro.
You could put a different account on there. They don't have to know.
They don't have to know. I would. Yes. Yeah. What I would probably do these days if I were going that route is I would use the Pliny plugin, which I already have, or one of the plugins. Again, I'll put the link in the show note. And I would get a nice power amp, and I would carry my laptop and a power amp around. That's what I would do.
There you go, man. Minimal setup.
Yep. No more do I have to worry about tubes getting old, tubes being broken in.
Well, I mean, those MacBooks are not super sturdy. I might want to back up one of those at least.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Tell me about your new MacBook, man.
Well, I mean, I got it to, like, it came earlier today. So they sent me a work laptop, 13-inch MacBook Pro, with the new, my favorite thing about it is the keyboard. It's got one of the new, I think they call them the Magic Keyboard now. But it feels like the keyboards that I know and love, like the wireless ones, maybe even a little spongier. And, yeah, it, I don't know. It's great so far. I haven't, like, stress tested it or anything. Tomorrow will be my first day working with it. So we'll see how it drives the 5K display, which I assume it'll be fine.
So what's your setup going to be? You're going to try to primarily just use that for work, or are you going to, I don't know, how are you going to divvy things up? Because right now you told me you're sitting in front of two monitors, one's a Mac and one's a PC, and then now you've got the new 13-inch there.
Right. Yeah, so I am sitting in front of two monitors. One, the one on my right is PC. The one on my left is Mac. So I have a 5K LG display for the Mac, and I have a 144Hz monitor for gaming. And yeah, so on the Mac side, it's just one cord to plug everything in. So I plug one USB-C, or I guess Thunderbolt cord, into my Mac, and it plugs into my interface, my USB hub, like monitor, everything, just one cord. So that just, my Mac laptop usually just sits on top of my PC tower on the side of my desk. And it's pretty, honestly, it's pretty easy. It's pretty seamless so far. So I'll probably just, instead of plugging into my 15-inch MacBook, I'll just plug into the 13-inch MacBook.
Oh, that's true. You don't have to even change anything. You just plug it in and away you go.
Just one cord.
Yep. And it should be able to drive the 5K no problem, I think.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a 13-inch MacBook Pro, space gray. I don't know, whatever specs they decided to give you.
It's a 4-core. Let me open it really quick. I can see.
Give us the deets.
It has a real escape key, which is weird because I find now that I'm used to the touch bar escape key that I don't push it down. I just kind of slap it. I slap the escape key with my pinky, and so now it doesn't push the key down all the way.
Garbage.
Let me see here. About it.
How's a 13-inch size for you?
I like 13-inch size.
Cool.
Because I mean, I really use it when it's not plugged into a monitor, but for traveling or going somewhere, it is nice to have the smaller form factor. Yeah, it's a 1.7 gigahertz quad core i7 with 16 gigs of RAM. So plenty enough for web work.
One would hope so, until you start running Node and React.
Oh yeah.
And Electron and Chrome and debug tools.
We'll see. Yeah. We'll see how it works out tomorrow, I guess, because yeah, I am working on a React project right now and it is all Webpack, so got to chunk a lot of JS. Of course it has to turn TypeScript into JavaScript first too.
Oh yeah. Really all it's doing is just turning everything into heat.
Right. But I don't know, it seems fine so far. It didn't get too wild, like installing Ruby and stuff earlier. It was fine. Seems all right. I'm not too worried about it, honestly.
Cool.
As long as I can feel productive. And I have all the apps that I'm already familiar with on it. So I think like a few weeks ago, I just subscribed to SetApp, which is what, like,
I was just going to bring up SetApp.
I had a hard time just like deciding to pay the $10 for it. But most things what did I install already? So I'm already using Bartender
Let's back up. So SetApp, for those who don't know, it's a subscription app store. So you pay, what is the membership?
It's like $10. And then you can add additional devices. They have iOS apps now too. So you could add an iPhone or iPad device for another like $2 a month or something.
Well, how does that work? Does it with signing and stuff? Because they don't allow alternate app stores on iOS.
So you would say you go to the SetApp app and it says that there's an iOS version available, and I believe you scan a QR code.
Seems interesting. Okay. I have lots of questions, but yeah, so SetApp is $10 a month, and then yeah, $2.50 extra a month per extra device. And yeah, it's just there's a lot of utilities on here. A lot of them are kind of samey, and a lot of them are very, very specific, like focused use cases, which makes it kind of hard for me because it's kind of choice paralysis. Yeah. It's like you forget you have some of these things. But for me alone, having Tables Plus, having I-step menus. I think that alone is a price of admission for me. It's great.
Yep. So I've already installed Tables Plus. To be fair, though, I do just use JetBrains SQL stuff, but I do use Tables Plus sometimes.
Tables Plus is awesome.
So that would have been DataGrip for JetBrains stuff.
Oh, I'm doing this 24-hour wallpaper thing too. I've got this hooked up. So just user-generated, wallpapers that change throughout the time of day, and they cycle through all different cities and landscapes and stuff. Pretty nice.
Yeah. So I'm using Bartender, iStat Menus, Time Meter, which is a really good time tracking app. We do track time at MetaLab, but not in like having to account for 40 hours a week for work. It's more so that we can make sure that we're estimating things correctly and, making sure that, everyone has enough to do. You know, I've worked for companies before where we literally had to get 40 hours on a timesheet every week. And this isn't that. It's more, like I said, it's more so just making sure that we're being efficient with our time and also making sure that we're not blowing money as a consultancy. But TimeMater, basically you can auto track based on the application or window you have open. So I just set up different rules. So I'm like, if I'm on this site or this app is open or whatever, just start tracking engineering. So when I'm working on client projects, I just track it under engineering. So if I have any dev tool open or whatever, it just automatically starts tracking for engineering, which is nice. And then at the end of the day, I can just tally and put it in our app. What else am I using? GitFox I use sometimes. I used to use Tower. I stopped paying for it because I was using JetBrains a lot. But GitFox, when I do need or feel like I want a more like dedicated GUI, GitFox is fine for that. Shimo, some of our clients or the client I'm working with now, I have to use a VPN to access any other stuff. And Shimo is a pretty good VPN client. What's really cool is that they can do split tunneling. So I can route certain traffic to their VPN. And then if I have YouTube, I don't have to like worry about watching YouTube on their network.
I need to install this right now and get rid of TunnelBlick out of here.
Yep, that's what I did. I got rid of TunnelBlick. Yep.
I didn't even know that. See, this is the thing. I don't even know half the stuff is on here.
Yeah. What else did I install? Because I'm using some other things too.
I really should put Bartender on here because on my MacBook, even on the 16-inch, it's more than halfway across the screen now.
Yeah, I use Bartender a lot. I'm going to put a link to Shimo in the show notes here as well because it's a really good one. I'm using SetApp, and the only other subscription I have is JetBrains stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling comfortable. All the keyboard shortcuts I know and love are there. Most of the things I have already sync via iCloud. So I do have my personal iCloud sync to it, but that is what it is. I don't know.
You still using Dropbox for anything or?
Never. Not in years.
That's cool. I didn't know.
So Shimo is a huge tool or a really great tool. Proxyman, I use that as well sometimes. I think I might have talked about this in the last episode, Proxyman.
Yeah. We need to have a whole episode just on tools. I mean, we talk about them enough, but it would be cool to take like a deep dive in some of this stuff.
Meter. I use Meter a lot. So I'm on like 6 Zoom calls a day now. And so Meter just sits in your menu bar. And it just tells you when the next Zoom call is or when next whatever call is, Google Meet or whatever it is. And then a minute before it's time, it just pops open a little thing in the notification center and you click on it and it just opens the call for you, whether it's Zoom or Google or whatever else. So that's super handy.
I see Luminar Flex in here. I've been using, I don't see regular Luminar in here though, but I've been using Luminar as a Lightroom replacement. And they have really cool AI stuff there. It's pretty wild. Been playing around with that a little bit. They have, if you have a landscape picture and you just say like replace the sky, you can just put like whatever sky you want it with just a menu option.
That's wild.
You don't have to select anything. It's crazy.
I remember when Photoshop got that context aware fill and everyone was like, this is magic.
It's still magic, man. Still magic.
Yeah. But so I've got ASDF with Go, Node, and Ruby going right now.
No Elixir. Womp womp.
Yeah. I need to add Python to that. Spoiler or foreshadow.
Well, Yeah, you should talk to not me, but someone who's more experienced about that, because Python has two built-in virtual environment managers, or it has one built-in, and then there's like another third-party one that's widely accepted. So look into those first before you set up ASDF, because they could clash, and like, who the heck knows?
Okay. But yeah, so I heard about the current project I'm working on is React and TypeScript, of course. But my next project coming up in November is either going to be Python or Go, depending on who knows what. The client, I suppose. But yeah, either one of Python or Go. So
that's a big range.
A big range, yes. I'm already going to start being on calls for this next week, and I don't start that till November. So hopefully I'll find out sooner than later, so that way I can skill up really quickly. But yeah, Python or Go. One of the two. I think it might be my fault, actually, because I filled out a spreadsheet of my skills matrix, and I noted that I had Go experience. So
you dug this hole for yourself.
I might have dug this hole for myself.
Go experience.
I mean, technically, I do. I've shipped an API written in Go to production. But that's what's going on with me, is just I am the Jira professional now. Actually, you know what? Maybe I can end with this. So shout out to Wes, who doesn't listen to the podcast, but he's the engineering lead that I'm taking this project over from. And we have two developers working with us on this project. And we do this, you know, we have like a 2-week sprint cycle, and then we have a sprint planning meeting and a sprint retro meeting. And so in the sprint planning meeting, he does this really cool exercise that I wanted to mention. So there was four of us on this last call. And so basically the sprint planning meeting is you look at the backlog, you look at the schedule of things, and you figure out, okay, what should be next? And then you drag the tickets into the sprint, and then each ticket in the sprint gets story points. So basically, how long do we think it's going to take? 0.5 points is it could take, you could probably do multiple 0.5s in a day. 1 point is 1 to 2 days. 2 points is 2 to 3 days. And 4 points is a week. And then you can do 8 if you think it's going to take a full sprint, like it's a big thing. So instead of him just kind of assigning these tasks and estimating everything himself, we did this thing where we looked at the ticket, we kind of like filled out the description, and then everyone on the count of 3 said what they thought, how many points it should take.
It's like, it sounds like a trust exercise.
Yeah, and the outlier has to defend himself. So one of the tickets was to like creating a data table of sorts that needed like sortable columns and things like that. And so I said it was probably going to be a 4, and a couple of people said it was probably going to be a 2, or I think everyone else said it would probably have been 2. So 2 to 3 days, I said it would be a full week. And so of course I had to defend my thoughts on that.
Oh boy.
And it was a really good discussion. So I have very recently, like I've complained about data tables on this show as close as a couple of months ago, right? And this project's using Material UI because we inherited some code from them and they are already using Material UI. And they do have a table component. But I started asking questions like, okay, well, this data table is on this part of the UI, but what happens if we have to start using it in other places? This part of the UI, the user list, does not need to be paginated. But what happens if we end up, you know, making this, or and we probably should make this table component model agnostic? And what happens if you do have to support pagination then, and you have to support, you know, action menus then, and have to support all these things? And it started ballooning really quick, right? Like, well, if it has to be agnostic, then you could theoretically spend as much time as you need to add to this thing, you know? And so that, I don't know, it was just a good discussion, and I really liked that exercise. To me, it kind of felt like it gave everyone like ownership or like a stake of everything going on. It wasn't just one person saying, you're doing this and this is how long you have to do it. It was all sort of a, you know, it was everyone's collective experience, everyone's collective perspectives, I guess, going into these tickets. And I don't know, I enjoyed it.
That's really interesting. One of the things you just can't do when you're
by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that when they went to the office, or when they all, before, you know, the company went mostly remote, or I guess all remote now, they used to have cards, so they would like count to 3, flip a card over.
Yeah, I was picturing like a whiteboard situation.
Yeah. We just did it in the Zoom chat, but
that makes sense.
yeah, it was still fun.
That's cool. It's a cool little technique. And you can almost picture it, like you could do it yourself over multiple days. You think about a problem and you come up with some estimate, and then you think about it tomorrow and you think about it some more, and then you revise the estimate. You know, you could kind of give yourself multiple votes over over time. It's not maybe as valuable, but, you know, instead of, as opposed to just estimating and just sending it out there, just estimating, just getting to work, estimating and then going to do something else and then re-estimating might be one strategy you could use to sort of approximate that.
Well, I mean, we've also always already had like things changing, right? Like, so you get in and then you're like, okay, well, this maybe doesn't necessarily work in practice. So then you have to have the design revised and the client has to sign off on the design revisions. And we have to talk about that before it goes back into dev. Right. So there's a whole, I'm so used to just like jumping in and doing everything. And this is like hurry up and wait, kind of like, okay, well, if we're going to make this change, then these four stakeholders have to be involved too, because they're calling the shots. And it has to make sense for them, you know? And then, of course, the research person has to be like, okay, well, now we have to work this into my user research plan. And it just like cascades, you know? So that's already been happening a little bit, where we're like having to, all right, let's move this ticket into the next sprint and pull this one back in here. And okay, so the client actually didn't finish their API like they said, so we have to move this feature back and have to pull this one up. And everything's always changing.
It's the only constant is change, right?
But that's what my job is sort of juggle all that. Mm-hmm. I guess the neat thing is that as the engineering lead, I get assigned half the number of points as everybody else, because I spend the rest of those points in calls and chasing cats, basically.
I think that's totally fair.
Yeah.
I know it's probably frustrating for you because you just want to do stuff. But if anything, like maybe, now that your work is really time boxed and, you know, at 5 o'clock, you can turn your brain off and you're also not writing as much code, maybe this will free you up for some, you know, spend some more time or energy to work on side projects. You know, I mean, I think once you get in the groove of things, I could definitely see that happening again, you know?
Yeah. I want to stream more too, especially like, you know, whether it's Python or Go, right? Cause I'm going to have to build a few things really quickly to sort of upskill before getting to that client work. So, that's one thing I'm hoping for is, yes, because everything just stops at 5. Everyone disappears. So even if I wanted to do stuff, I can only do stuff that isn't blocked. Or, you know what I mean? Like I can only do half of what my responsibilities are. So, and I've found out so far with the tickets I've been given, because it's only half, I can knock them out kind of quickly. And then, so I have a merge request in for everything I needed to do. The code's already written. It's just people are checking it. You know, even though I'm the engineering lead, I still want the junior dev and the other senior dev on the project to review it too. So, you know, all my stuff is up there and I'm just waiting for them to review it. So I'm like, now what? Okay, well, I should probably spend time thinking about the future and like planning the rest of it. You know what I mean? So
don't do it too quickly or they're going to start giving you more points.
They don't have control over that though. Guess who has control over that?
Ah.
That is right. That's right.
Seems like a system of checks and balances should be in place here, but that's not for me to decide.
That's for me to decide. And that's the problem, right?
Look at me.
Yeah.
I'm the lead now.
I'm enjoying it so far. I'm really glad that I decided to change things up.
That's awesome, man. I'm really excited for you. This is so cool to hear about. I like those little nuggets of experience that you pick up from just little tips and tricks like that. It's just great little things that you can take away from and apply them somewhere else.
And you know that I've already started talking about Vue in Tailwind.
You're proselytizing.
Yes.
I love it. Fighting the good fight.
When someone's complaining about something, I'm like, you know, there is a better way, my friend.
What happened to not being the guy that rocks the boat?
I'm not rewriting it in Nuxt.
Not yet.
I'm just putting bugs out there.
Do it during your free development time. Oh yeah, the React app that took you 2 weeks to write. I did it in 2 hours.
During the lunch and learns.
Yeah.
Remember style components.
Oof.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I guess if anyone out there does have experience in real time things, and you heard Rockwell's plea for help earlier, definitely reach out to us and share some experience.
You can reach us on Twitter. The show is DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shruckwell.
Everything we talked about today, it's going to be in the show notes. All the links, all the tasty links that we talked about today are going to be there. And if you're looking for the show notes, you can find them at dnc.show.
Although you might not be able to because Sean needs to fix the site because it's not up to date right now.
That's not my fault.
You're going to blame
Bucky.
Simplecast again? Oh, lead engineer Bucky. Executive producer.
Yeah, Bucky's fault. I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me.
No problem. I mean, I could look at it too. I have access to the repo. It's just we got to rewrite it next anyways.
Yeah.
We're streaming live on Twitch every Thursday night, 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern, twitch.tv/DNCcast. Yeah, I forgot the address. twitch.tv/DNCcast. Come join the chat, hang out with us and everyone else.
And last but not least, thanks to Spec for having us, putting this out in the world. And if you're into design and development related podcasts, you should go to spec.fm and see what they have to offer. I'll talk to you in a week.
All right. We'll get on a Zoom call.
I'll send you a calendar invite.
I'll mark it as maybe.
No, you'll be there.
All right, see you.